Presents to Murgatroyd. Oh,
welcome to the Behavioral Design Podcast. I'm Aline Holsworth, and here with me today, as always, is my co-host Samuel Saltzer.
Yay! Really excited for today's episode.
Me too. Did you hear how I called you Samuel there?
Very nice. I appreciate that. Yeah. And I do also say that I'm excited for episodes always, probably, but this time I really, really mean it. I think this is going to be a fun one. And based on our notes in terms of what we're going to cover, I think it's going to be a lot of good stuff. Killer, no filler, as some people say.
Indeed, yes. Today actually is the end of season three. This is our season three finale. So it's been an amazing season, I have to say. I was just reviewing all of our guests this year, and it's been incredible. So I'm sad to see it go, but you got to wrap it up and move on to the next one. So that's what we're doing today.
Yeah, could you say that maybe you're feeling grateful? Is that what you're alluding to?
I would say that. In fact, what a nice segue. Today, we are talking about gratitude, which I think is a especially pertinent topic for this time of year. I mean, really all year round, but I do find that people tend to forget a bit about gratitude in the sort of beginning to middle part of the year. And then towards the end, they start remembering. Once, at least in America, once Thanksgiving approaches. So now it's still on the mind. And I thought we could just talk a little bit about what we know about gratitude from the behavioral science research perspective, and then really dive into what we ourselves are grateful for. So a very lighthearted, mushy episode for us, but hopefully we'll get to cover also some of the happenings in behavioral science throughout the year. And, the good things that have been going on both on the academic side and the industry side, and maybe even in our own lives.
Yeah, it's kind of like a year in review in many ways. I think we're going to cover some of the good stuff from this year, some of, I think, the most important things to maybe think about, be grateful for. And if you haven't, for example, check out, because we're going to cover some of our favorite resources and stuff like that as well. So, yeah. Should we jump into gratitude? Can I ask you, Aline, do you have some form of gratitude practice?
I feel like I've shared this so many times with you on and off the podcast but at this point, but just so every single person in the world knows, I do have a daily gratitude practice. At dinner, before dinner, we say our gratefuls. This is sort of our secular thanks. And we just, go around the table and say what we're grateful for that day. It's a lot of fun. We never forget to do it unless we're in an awkward, like a big group setting, where you don't really feel comfortable imposing your tradition on everyone there, even though they probably would enjoy it and benefit from it.
Yeah.
And it covers all kinds of things. I think when you express gratitude more regularly, you start to be grateful for more obscure types of things. Whereas if you do it very rarely, you might stick to the very high level topics like my health, my family, my home, that sort of thing. But I think when you start to get bored of those big topics and you start going into, something that someone said today, or the way that the sun looked when you woke up that morning, or a particular line from a book, and I think it's fun to get a little bit more creative with your gratitude.
Yeah, no, I agree. And in some ways, talking about being creative, I recently was speaking to someone about, I'm trying to remember the researcher's name, but they wrote a book called No Sweat, I believe, talking about like how to make exercising something that is more immediately rewarding in the challenge of the lack of immediate rewards in many ways from exercising and stuff like this, where, we know we're supposed to do it. We do it oftentimes maybe begrudgingly, and it feels like a chore and a hard thing to do. And I'm going to find this research, but basically the importance of reframing some of the exercising of like, well, I don't have to go on a run, but I actually get to go on a run. Like I get to...
Mm-hmm. Lucky me.
Yeah, in some ways. Like I think it's, yeah, a form of gratitude practice, but it's kind of reframing things that you do in ways that kind of really highlights how you're grateful for doing them and why it's actually a positive, yeah, thing to be able to experience. So that's another way of maybe a twist of gratitude. But I love your practice. I think it's really, really awesome.
Yeah, thanks. And I think, you know, the research also shows that once you sort of establish this kind of regular practice of being grateful, you actually start to notice more things in your life that you have to be grateful for. So it actually contributes to your overall happiness as you're sort of, you know, more aware of the positive things going on. So you could have, you know, two people with that are in objectively the same situation, and the one that has been practicing gratitude actually notices more of the positive and feels better as a result of that, has a higher well-being than the one who's not paying attention to those things.
Cool. So anything else that the research tells us that we should be aware of when it comes to gratitude?
Well, actually, one of my favorite research papers from this year came out in Nature Human Behavior. And so I'm always kind of paying attention to what the science says about happiness and well-being and increasing these things, right? And so we were lucky enough to have a meta-analysis come out from Dunnigan, Folk, and Elizabeth Dunn. And they actually systematically looked at the most popular strategies that are kind of touted in the media, where they say, okay, what are the different approaches to improving your well-being? Well, so they identified expressing gratitude as one of them, but also enhancing sociability, exercising, practicing mindfulness and meditation, and increasing nature exposure. So these are the main strategies that they identified. And then they went into the evidence and they said, okay, like what is the strength of the literature that we can find on each of these strategies? And they compared them all. And they looked at, you know, things like, you know, for our more technical crew, you know, what proportion of these are pre-registered, and how many of them are sufficiently powered. So they have enough participants in their research studies in order to detect an effect. And what they did was, first, I think one of the sad findings of this meta-analysis was just that there is not a whole lot of great evidence out there. There's lots and lots and lots of studies, but not very many of them that are sufficiently powered and also pre-registered. With that said, gratitude really came out on top as wow, being one of the strategies with the most, let's say with the most robust evidence base. And so that is quite promising, especially as we talk about all the things that we're grateful for today, that, you know, you can do this very simple exercise of practicing your gratitude and get a pretty nice well-being boost out of it.
Wow. So we performed better than both physical exercise and nature exposure.
That's right. Yeah. Wow. There was very weak evidence for nature exposure, you know, but part of it is just a lack of evidence,
sure,
right?
Sure.
They're looking at a very particular kind of study, and they just didn't find a lot of those studies. And then exercise, there's incredible body of research showing that in clinical populations, so for people who are depressed or have anxiety, that exercise can be really effective in helping there. This meta-analysis actually didn't look at clinical populations. They just looked at general pop studies. And so, you know, you can say maybe it works in this case, but it doesn't in this other case, or maybe actually it does work in general pop studies. There just haven't been... those studies just haven't been conducted in a rigorous way.
To nerd out, do you think there's some form of, or do you know if there's some form of inverse kind of effect when it comes to gratitude in terms of, you know, more clinical populations?
Can you be too grateful? Oh, interesting. No, I would not expect that to be the case. Mm. Do you?
I guess like one hypothesis could be that, you know, if you are depressed, a gratitude practice might either be harder to do for some reasons, or maybe it will lead mm-hmm. to still like not the same effect for various types of reasons.
I think it would have a larger effect. And that's because there's always something to be grateful for. And I think it's especially important actually to find things that to be grateful for when it feels like the world is sort of tumbling around you, right? That finding those little bright spots, I think, can be all the more important if you can.
Yeah. And I guess maybe I'm colored by this thing of like someone who has experienced something. And this actually happened to me a few times where like some people are like very good intentioned, but like something really bad has happened. And they like the first thing they say is like, you know, sorry to hear that, but you know, you have so much to be grateful for, you know, don't be.
that's a little different.
That's different.
One thing that comes to mind actually where I can absolutely see it backfiring is if you're writing a gratitude list, but it's too long, right? And this goes back to the research of, you know, write three things about that you love about your partner, or write 10 things that you love about your partner. And it's really easy and fluent to come up with the three things, but coming up with 10 things is a challenge. And so you start to ask yourself, do I really love my partner? Right. And so I think the same thing, same effect could be found with gratitude, where you're coming up with a list of 100 things to be grateful for. Like suddenly there's, you feel like nothing is good in the world.
Yeah. Well, super interesting. That's actually, I found that study really interesting. And I will stop going to nature and I will just stick to my journaling.
No. I don't think that's the answer.
But yeah, let's talk as well now maybe about what we're grateful for in behavioral science. And there are
so much.
Yes. And maybe we can start on the more academic side, because I think it's been quite an interesting time looking at behavioral science from this kind of more academic lens of some people might actually say like, well, it's been a problematic year because, you know, we have seen a lot of things unravel. There's been some controversies. Should we be grateful, Aline, do you think?
I'm sticking with what I said. There's always something to be grateful for, even when times seem as dark as they are. And there's quite a bit. So on the academic side, I think the open science movement is going strong. Mm. There was a very, very cool paper that came out quite recently looking at the impact of pre-registration on replication. So I'm sure that most of our listeners are familiar with what some would call the replication crisis. And, you know, there have been questions over time. Is this actually doing any? Are replication studies, replication attempts, doing anything to actually improve the field, to make the science better? And another paper in Nature Human Behavior, I guess, it's a lot of good stuff coming out of Nature Human Behavior this year. Maybe we should be grateful for that journal.
I agree. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. They found that compared to the normal sort of average rate of replication, which is about 50% or the range of 30-70%, depending on various factors, they found that when studies are pre-registered, in this one study, this one research paper where they compared a few different experiments, they found an 86% replication rate, which is very high.
Yeah, that is massive.
Amazingly high. Yeah, so that is extremely promising. I'm very grateful that there seems to be some real evidence for the positive effect of pre-registering studies.
Yeah. And I think, you know, as an applied practitioner, I think we can all feel in general that it's at least for me, I guess it's always been tricky with kind of academic research because, you know, you're trying to take something that's been studied academically in various contexts and then trying to make sense. Like, can I use this in the context where I'm kind of doing my applied work? And I guess I've always felt that, you know, it's hard sometimes and it's easier to rely on things like, let's say, self-determination theory or something where there's like a larger body of research and you can kind of more easily maybe feel confidence rather than smaller studies, especially things regarding like some random study on a bias, for example. That's always felt like...
And there's just one.
Exactly. So like, I've always felt that stuff was a little bit, you know, scary to get too close to and touch. And I honestly think this is starting to become a time where I feel a little more confident to rely on certain things because it's been kind of these kind of changes where, you know, it's easy to also kind of look at behavioral science and say like, oh no, we have had this replication crisis, but a lot of fields in medical sciences and many other things, it's been kind of similar kind of evolutions of improving methods to ensure better replicability. And it's somewhat inevitable. And maybe we should really, you know, again, try to look at things from like a glass half full side of things. You know, we can give a shout out to the likes of Terra Colada and so on for offering this time where there's so much attention and efforts going into understanding, like, you know, do these things replicate? Can we trust them? Has there been some mistakes being made in the past? And yeah, it seems like
looking at data integrity and assessing other people's work.
Yeah. And we wouldn't find out if people didn't care, if we didn't improve and all these things didn't happen, like we would actually, you know, live in an illusion state of like that everything was perfect before or.
Yeah. Which is so funny. I always think about, you know, there are fields that are not assessing themselves as seriously. And, you know, they're just going on in their blissful ignorance, right? Whereas I think, you know, there's the clear downside is that now social science has this sad reputation for, you know, for the replication crisis. But also look at all that the field is doing to correct it. That's what I like to focus on.
Yeah. And all the good stuff that's still is there. And I think if you look at the bigger scheme of things, there's so much that is working and that it's really great that we can be very grateful for in terms of, again, I think we had this maybe conversation more kind of, I don't know, at some point, but just the idea that like when some of these things come out, you know, if someone asked me like, does this change the way you work? You'll basically be saying like, oftentimes no, because many of these things that haven't replicated, I honestly haven't really used much in my work. And it's like a relatively small part of the bigger piece of research that we're kind of always looking at and so on. So, and if it's been used, it's been kind of maybe part of, you know, a literature review containing many, many other things. And it was kind of a small part of that and so on. So it's, yeah, I don't know. I find it hard to be overly in crisis mode or something like this. I feel like there's so much good stuff there.
Yeah. I tend to be more comfortable with crisis mode, I think.
Yeah, it's another way of thinking about it. Is there anything else you want to shout out or say about kind of the academic side?
No, I think you know, lots of bright spots on the academic side. Let's talk about the industry side of behavioral science and what we're grateful for there.
Yes. So, I think a lot of things. So first of all, you know, it's still clear that there are kind of people and organizations that are seeing the need for behavioral design. So,
Some do. All.
Yeah,
there is demand there. It exists.
Yeah, and I mean, and maybe, you know, what I don't know if you would agree, but I've seen this kind of thing this year where maybe increasingly it's become the case where a lot of people who are behavioral scientists have found work, but maybe a little bit more so under different terms than before. So I think maybe there's been a little bit of this kind of like understanding that organizations need to solve problems and then oftentimes really care what you call certain things. And then they're like, well, we have this budget for a user researcher or for, you know, X, Y, and Z. And then, you know, it's hard for them to like reconfigure their setups and so on. And so if there's a behavioral scientist that comes and says, I can do that job, they say, okay, we'll give you that job. We'll call you a user researcher, but we appreciate your behavioral science skills.
Yeah. All these roles in disguise, essentially.
Yeah. So I think that's been a trend. I guess you would agree in that.
I think so. I still think there are some gaps where hiring managers are not necessarily seeing the potential, especially in the product manager, product designer space. I think that when I think about the perfect product manager, I think of a behavioral scientist. But that's not necessarily the most popular view. And I think that the effort that it requires to go from I'm hiring a product manager to manage this product to understanding how a behavioral scientist would be perfect at that role, I think that's maybe it's a little too much mental effort for many hiring managers to see.
Yeah.
But we're talking about what we're grateful for.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, okay, is this under the umbrella of grateful? I'm not sure. But one comment that I've been thinking about this is that I do think there are increasingly like still a need for behavioral science people, but maybe with a little bit more demand to make behavioral science useful. Whereas maybe before you can get away with, you know, talking about behavioral science and talking up the excitement and interest and the fascinating aspects of human behavior, maybe without having to as much make it useful and kind of in an applied setting, solve problems and so on.
You basically have to dial up the applied in applied behavioral science to really say, how are we translating these findings to the actual product or service?
Yeah. And in a way, I'm grateful for that. I think that's a good...
I'm grateful for that.
It's good. Awesome. Yeah. Yeah. Good, what more, Arlene, would you say?
Well, this is specific to us, but you know, and I don't think that we've shared with our listeners our new collaboration.
Yeah,
but
big news.
Maybe now is a good time to do so. Sam and I have actually started working together through Nuance, our new company, doing consulting, and so far, I mean, it's early days, but we're having an amazing time. And we're already getting to work with just incredible companies that are interested in using behavioral design to improve their digital products.
Yeah. No, and I think to talk a little bit more about what Nuance is, the whole idea was to find an opportunity to collaborate around the world with people that are doing good applied behavioral science work and then kind of form some form of opportunity to then help companies and organizations that wants to, you know, especially in the digital side of things, apply behavioral science to improve their products or services. So yeah, it's very much a new thing. I guess we officially kind of got things started in October or something, but it's been really fun start and really fun to doing this together. So definitely grateful for that.
Same. And I would extend that too to the whole behavioral design community, right? All of the people, so both the people that work with us in Nuance, but also our peers outside of Nuance.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, for me, that's been this thing that I've seen since I started working in the field, and that's still there, which is a really high openness to collaborate. Basically, you know, Nuance is maybe an example of that, of course, but also, you know, with Habit Weekly, we have really, really good relationship and a lot of collaborations with a bunch of great, great people and organizations. And it's always this kind of like feeling for the most part where it's, you know, let's do something together. Let's, instead of competing, let's collaborate and let's do things better together. I really don't take that for granted because I know that's not always the case. It's very easy to get stuck in this fields where it's very, very competitive and you kind of fight for pieces of crumbs of the pie instead of trying to expand the pie. And I think in behavioral science so far, we have been able to sustain this quite collaborative community. And there's so many great people that we could probably shout out that's helped us in various ways and collaborated with us in various ways. But the list will be too long to go through. So
I know. Yeah. And I feel like we couldn't have a gratitude episode of our podcast without shouting out to all of our amazing podcast guests. This was just such an incredible season. Oh my gosh. I mean, like, we had an incredible lineup, starting with Lori Santos talking about happiness, Sanjay Srivastava on personality, Heather Cole Lewis on engagement, Dave Pizarro on disgust. I think officially we called the episode Controversial Opinions. Yeah. I'm not sure how well that actually characterizes it, but that was a fun one.
Yeah, it was a really fun one. And I guess we were like, should we call it disgusting? With Dave Pizarro, it sounded kind of, you know, not maybe fully fair. But yeah, that was a really fun one. And then we had Paul Bloom coming to speak about Psych, his latest book. And as a side note, I did have a really fun moment this summer with some friends where we had kind of period in the summer where we hung out in a house together, basically, with some friends. And then there were a few conversations where, like, randomly people were talking about, first, I think it was Emily Oster. And I was like, yeah, we actually had her on a podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And then the next day...
BFFs.
Yeah. The next day, there was a dinner conversation about Empathy and Paul Bloom. And I was like, yeah, been on our podcast as well. And my friends looked at me, you know, like in a way they haven't seen me before. I feel like for the first time, they're like, wow.
That's so funny.
So cool.
Newfound respect.
Yeah, finally.
Yeah, finally. Yeah. Finally recognized for the hero that you are.
Yeah, that was fun to just like, you know, as an example as well with some of the many great guests we've had, you know, that... All of my friends are like very non-behavioral science people. So it's fun that we have this kind of overlap. And we had Nick Shader, where we talked about a lot of behavioral science regards to public policy. We had our most listened to episode of the year, according to Spotify Wrapped, with Mitesh Patel on healthy gamification.
That was a great one. And then we had Linda Babcock, where we talked about non-promotable tasks and her book, The No Club.
It's all good.
And then finally, we wrapped things up with Steph Habif, who talked about diabetes, and Aarti Rao on human-centered behavioral design and medication adherence.
Yeah.
So that has, that's an impressive season, I have to say.
Yeah, and a really nice mix across topics, guests.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, really fun season. And it was fun, of course, talking about Spotify Wrapped. We have a few true fans. There were a few hundreds of people, of you, that had our podcast as the number one podcast of the year.
Number one.
And that is not stated preferences in terms of like what you say, but revealed preferences, amount of time listened to. So we appreciate that even more so, revealed preferences.
Yeah.
In that. So, and then, yeah, we had a few thousand over in, still had her in the top 10 in listens, which is still very, very good. Yeah. So thanks everyone who's been supporting and listening to the podcast. And maybe this next segment of this episode can be a little bit of a kind of a gift to you in some ways. We've gone through our favorite resources in the field and developments. And hopefully these can provide you some extra opportunity to make sure that you didn't miss some good stuff this year and you, yeah, get a chance to explore them. So should we start with AI?
So we did actually ask you, our listeners, what you wanted to hear about in this episode. And the number one request was for us to talk about behavioral science and AI. And of course, we've already had an episode where we dove into this pretty comprehensively. But there have been some more developments in AI related to behavioral science that I think we could touch upon.
Yeah. Yeah. And that episode was, I think, our first episode of this season. So
it indeed was.
Yeah. It was in February. And I guess there has been some developments. Yeah. So Habit Weekly had, in a way, a baby this year in that Behavior Bytes came to be. It was a idea initially earlier in the year to kind of find an opportunity to collect all the good stuff, but also the great people, specifically regarding behavioral science and AI, in kind of one space, one newsletter, one community. And yeah, it was launched and has been really, really great. Kudos to Deidre and Laura and Kiran and everyone involved with running that community. It's grown quite a bit, and I think it has a few thousand people actively involved. So that's been really great to see coming out, and something to check out as well if you want to continue to follow and stay on top of things with a kind of a monthly review of here's the best stuff to read and review and so on. What has been else on your radar when it comes to AI?
I have had a lot of fun playing around with the different GPTs that have come out. So you know, you have your sort of generic open AI chat GPT and so on. But then people have started creating their own more specialized GPTs. And so I've been most excited to find those that are based on behavioral coaching, large language models. And those, the intention is to, you know, you put in as a prompt writer, some behavioral challenge that you're having, or you explain, you know, what you're trying to achieve. And the GPT will then give you somewhat personalized recommendations for achieving that goal or overcoming your barrier. There's still, I think, a long way to go in terms of making these tools very effective. And I'm not going to call out any of those that I've toyed with. But I do think this is a very exciting space, and I'm excited to actually keep working on projects that are directly doing this.
Yeah. And I think like maybe they are kind of like approaching some form of like very kind of junior level research assistant status, or like something where,
yeah,
where it's kind of like it actually can save some time. And especially combined with we had a great have a weekly seminar actually on like literature reviews earlier this year, where we looked into also like the AI tools for doing literature reviews, like ResearchRabbit and Elicit and other tools like this. And I think in combination, you can actually save so much time, and oftentimes I would say also make better literature reviews. I feel like both the time spent has gone down for me, and the quality I would say have improved as well in terms of my kind of helping reviewing some of the literature, going back to that and coming up with some little bit maybe different ideas or different insights or conclusions as well. So yeah.
Yeah, I love that, using AI as a tool to really kind of boost your efficiency as an expert in your field. Because it does feel to me like, and I'm sure I've said this before, that we're nowhere near to replacing behavioral science expertise, but certainly in maybe bolstering your productivity by, helping with the literature review as a good example.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I guess this is maybe, again, not sure if I can squeeze this in under under gratitude or gratefulness, but there recently was this post by Sam Altman where he basically, who's the ex-CEO, now new
what is
CEO
he now?
of OpenAI. Yeah. And he basically said that, large language models will become expert in persuasion before they become kind of, call it AGI or like really powerful. And I think what he means to say there is that, they are becoming quite good in terms of like, if you wanted to have some form of like one-on-one chat with someone to try to convince them to maybe vote differently or make certain choices and change opinions, you can at very, very near future imagine that many of these large language models can be trained to do that in a way where, for countries that have a big election coming up in 2024, it's kind of...
like, where are you thinking of?
Well, there are actually a lot of different countries, but yeah, I was thinking about America.
Yeah.
It's a little bit worse in terms of that you can quite easily these days be able to train a large language model to kind of use something like, let's say, motivational interviewing, and some of the things we know from research helps in kind of changing someone's opinion. And you can imagine that being used in chat forums or one-on-one chats or other things as kind of in disguise of being a real person and actually convincing people better than maybe even a real person could, because they won't be as impeded by their maybe emotional or other things that could actually make it hard to change someone's opinion because you're kind of like emotionally invested yourself. So not grateful for that. And actually a little bit kind of one of the things that I would kind of raise a warning flag around to be aware of. But
Okay. But let's get back to what we are grateful
for. Are there
any other resources that have come out this year that you feel grateful for?
Yeah, so a lot of great resources. So I had a kind of look at what has been the most popular resources within Habit Weekly this year in terms of what has been most clicked on, opened, shared, and all this stuff. And a few really stood out. So one was a resource covering the best women in behavioral science by Darcy Piechowski. And I know you have done something similar in terms of an article for Forbes, I believe. And this one became very popular and also had an amazing kind of comment section of just increasingly showcasing how many great women in behavioral science exist.
And importantly, a LinkedIn community came out of that. So if you're a woman in behavioral science, try and find this and join it.
Yeah, we'll link to that, of course. And so we mentioned earlier Data Colada in the episode. And relating to what Data Colada has been doing, one person that should be given a big shout out is Zoe Ciani. And she wrote a fantastic post on lessons on fraud and whistleblowing, as she was one of the whistleblowers in the case with Francesca Zeno. And
yeah,
that was really, I think, fantastic overview of some of the existing problems with academia, you know, her experience, and also some lessons along the way. So I think that one is definitely worthwhile to check out and read.
Yeah, I would definitely add that I'm so grateful that she came forward. And also, you know, even before she in some ways came out, right? She, all the work that she did to expose the fraud, just so brave and commendable. I'm so grateful for her.
Yeah, hear, hear. And she has a great website as well, where, again, this article that we'll link to is there, but also there's a lot of good stuff there as well. So that's a resource worth exploring. Then we had actually an article written by some co-workers of us, Hassan and Rus. They wrote a fantastic deep dive on choice overload. And really, that choice overload is something we talk about a lot. It's often something that people are aware of, even outside of behavioral science. But it's often limited to like a very overly simplistic understanding of what it means. And they, I think, really mm-hmm. well illustrated kind of at four different levels of understanding what makes for choice overload. And it's not about the numbers, kind of the idea is that it's not about the number of choices. It's much more than that. And I think they do a great job of highlighting that. We have also a, talking about numbers, seven routes to applied behavioral science experimentation and observation, which was a really beautiful guide, but also I was going to say beautiful visualization of how you can go in an applied world to experimentation. Like, when should you run an RCT versus something else and so on. And that was done by Effective Advisory in collaboration with OECD. And that's a really beautiful poster to put on your wall, but also a really wonderful report that they put together.
Yeah, really cool.
Yeah, and then we have a few more maybe to highlight. We have Mapping Behavioral Journeys, which was a really nice post by Common Thread, where they kind of actually highlighted some have a weekly resources that we've created in the past, but also showed how they're using behavioral journeys. And I think that was really wonderful. We have all, I think, mentioned a few times, but we should realize that actually Michael Holsworth published his manifesto for applied behavioral science this year. It felt mm-hmm. like actually yeah. it's been some time, but actually I realized it was in, I think, March or February of this year. So,
oh yeah. That's so, I feel like we've had that forever.
Yeah.
It's such a staple now.
Yeah. And then the final two that I wanted to highlight is one article by Connor Joyce on behavioral science as a specialization, which actually covers part of the things we mentioned initially in the conversation about, you know, what do we call ourselves? Like, should you specialize as a behavioral scientist, or should you be, you know, be more of a generalist, or, you know, how to think about that? So I think that was really nice one. And then lastly, Jared Peterson wrote an article called The Science of Context, really hitting home what I think maybe is the main thing that I've said the most this year after having read that article, like something that's just been repeated in my mind and in conversations, basically being that when we run, you know, behavioral science interventions, it's not so much as we just testing, let's say, a nudge or an intervention, as much as we're testing our understanding of the context. So mm-hmm. the idea is that, you know, when we, let's say, have an intervention and it doesn't succeed, well, probably what it tells us is that we don't know the context well enough. It kind of speaks to this idea that, like, behavioral science is a science of context, really trying to understand the context we're trying to change. Mm-hmm. And
or should be. Or should maybe be. Isn't always in practice,
that's true.
But ideally.
It should be, yeah. And I think he really wonderfully illustrates and talks about that in that piece. So thank you all that we've highlighted here. Like, thank you for writing these things and contributing to these things and creating these things. We're super grateful.
Yeah.
And we'll link to all of those in the show notes.
So quite a bit to be grateful for in behavioral science. Lots of developments this year. What about in our own lives, Sam? I guess I would say that in some ways it's been a pretty hard year for me and my family. I think that you might say the same. I'll let you speak for yourself. But I also would say that there's still quite a bit to be grateful for in our personal lives. What do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely been a difficult period on kind of a family level, we're kind of quite affected by one of the big conflicts in the world. And that's gone on now for almost 2 years, which has not been easy. We also had a close family member that's passed away recently. And I would say the thing that has been very nice is the kind of the unity that we've been able to have within the family and supporting each other and kind of everyone, you know, doing their bit to really coming closer and finding ways to be there and do what they can. So I do feel very grateful for having family, but also friends that have provided that kind of support and shared support system of sort. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's everything, really.
Honestly, yeah. It's very easy to, again, neglect or like not realizing how big of a difference it makes. But it makes all the difference, yeah.
Yeah, and earlier we talked about the behavioral science community and how grateful we are for them in a more general way. But I would just add that all the advice that I've gotten from my behavioral science friends and the introductions and all the sort of practical and emotional support that I've gotten from leaning on that community this year has meant a ton to me. I'm so grateful for that.
Nice. And I want to squeeze in that I'm grateful for Ange Postecoglou. Probably doesn't mean anything to you or most people.
I literally have no idea what that is.
That's okay. What that is. But yeah, I'll leave that as a thing for people who know will know.
You're not going to say what it is?
Well, it has to do with it's somewhat meaningless. It has to do with sports and the team that I support in football. But I was going to say, would you be up for me sharing something that is very close to my heart, that has actually been also something that helped me this year, which has been films and cinema? It's actually always been a big part of my life, but I do find it increasingly also this year, it's become like really the place where, maybe this going too far, but basically where I feel like it's my cathedral. Like that, it's where I find peace. It's where I find like a lot of
your escape.
And it's been some amazing films. So this is a little bit impromptu, but I used before this put together what I think is the 10 best films of 2023. Should I go through them?
Whoa, 10. Sure.
Okay, I'll go through some of the early ones quickly. But Infinity Pool, number 10, it's a weird one. We have actually, I realized that I thought I liked Oppenheimer better than Barbie, but I actually rated Barbie higher. So wow. Oppenheimer, number 9, Barbie, number 8. One Fine Morning, number 7. French film, really, really lovely. But it deals with this thing, which actually I've been working with this year as well, which is aidance in French, which is meaning your care provider or caregiver. So when you have a family member who needs to take care of you, or you have to take care of a family member, and the burden and the challenges and all of the things that comes with that, and how they can often be kind of forgotten in society, in that like it's kind of an invisible burden or an invisible thing to carry with us. So One Fine Morning. Then we're talking about weird with Infinity Pool. Bo is Afraid. Did you hear about this film, Aline?
I have not.
It's incredibly weird, incredibly fun and strange and absurd. I would say the first third of the film is maybe the best thing I've seen in a long time. It's also a little bit graphic, so a little bit warning there, but a very odd film. Number 5, we have Past Lives. Maybe in some people's catalog, the best film of the year. It's been very celebrated, probably one of the kind of Oscar favorites. Have you heard any of these, by the way? Does this?
I'm waiting for you to get to one that I've actually seen. Maybe one of these.
Okay.
I'm
don't,
still waiting.
Don't hold your breath, maybe, because now it's getting a little bit interesting. So number 4 is a Ukrainian film, Luxembourg. Fantastic, funny, heartfelt, family-based film. Really good. Passages, number 3, French film. Really, really good as well. And it's about pretty much like following a really dislikable figure through the whole film, but still caring about this person and their relationships. And it's one of those films that makes you care about someone that is like a complete narcissist and not the greatest person. Second, is a film called Close, which is a Netherlands and Belgian, I think, made film about these two boys who are in their kind of, I think around 11 years old initially, are very, very close, but then coming through this phase of going from being kids to being teenagers, going to a new school, and just kind of that thing where you don't really have an opportunity to really maybe speak to, you're too young to be able to speak about these challenges you're facing as you're growing up. And you have these two childhood friends that are kind of like starting close, but then starting to kind of find this wedge between their friendship. And their closeness has been kind of also maybe in the new school being mocked as like, are they homosexual? Are they this and that? And they kind of grapple with this in a way which is quite beautiful in the film, but also sad. And then the final film that you definitely haven't seen, Aline, but one worth seeing is Fallen Leaves, which is a Finnish film, a very unorthodox love story of a sort. And it's the most Finnish film I've ever seen in my life. It's all what I imagine Finland to be like, being someone living in Sweden. And it's a very lovely film, Fallen Leaves. Yeah, romantic film, but in a very kind of unorthodox way. Like the most un-American romantic comedy that you'll see.
There's no meet cute? What?
There is a meet cute, but it like happens in a not the way that most meet cutes happen. Yeah.
Interesting. Well, I don't know if this says more about your obscure taste in films or my lack of being in touch with popular culture, but no, I think I had I'm aware of 2 out of 10 of those. And yes, they were Barbie and Oppenheimer.
Yeah, I was gonna say, you haven't seen Barbie? So,
I'm not willing to admit to that. Okay. But no.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I really tried.
Okay. Well, yeah. That was obviously me kind of maybe indulging in, again, one of my big side interests in life. But maybe that gave you some things to watch. We're getting into holiday periods. So if you have some extra time, all of these films should be available to stream and watch online. So yeah, that wraps up probably this episode. I've also, I guess, must say that we have celebrated 5 years of Habit Weekly, which is insane. Mm-hmm. 5 years, Aline. 5 years.
Congratulations. Yeah.
Yeah.
Good work.
Well, I don't know, but it's crazy that it's been 5 years. It's a long, long time. I didn't realize we started in 2018. And yeah, you've been along for the journey. When did we start the podcast together? 3 years ago?
Was it 20? Yeah, I think it was about 2020, yeah. About 3 years ago.
Yeah.
That weird that was 3 years ago, but right. Whatever, time.
Yeah.
I have one more grateful to share. Ooh. Sam. I am grateful for you. Oh. I'm grateful for this podcast, for all of our collaborations, our friendship, everything that falls under the Sam bucket.
Well, yeah, I can't say any more than, yeah, right back at you. I think the only reason why, honestly, I feel like the podcast is awesome is because I'm doing it with you. Like, I really look forward to these conversations. And
same.
Yeah. It's very much an excuse to just have some fun chats, talk about the stuff happening in the field. And again, going back to having some great guests on and talking to some cool people. So yeah, super grateful for you as well. Really, really happy to be doing the podcast together, now also working together. So yeah.
Yeah.
So thanks everyone for this year. Very, very happy to have shared it with you. Thanks for listening to the podcast and again, supporting us in all of the ways that you do. Hope that we provided some value to you, that we provided some, you know, interesting listens, some ideas, some perspectives that you haven't come across otherwise. And again, do the great stuff that I'm sure you're doing in also bringing behavioral science into the world. So share that with us as well. We'd love to hear from you. And again, thank you. And all the best.
And that's season 3.
Yay, season 3.
Time to wrap up another episode of the Behavioral Design Podcast. We hope you enjoyed the show. Oh, and I am an AI. Yeah, welcome to Uncanny Valley. Sam and Aline told me this is going to be an awesome season. So make sure to subscribe and help spread the word. Maybe share the podcast with a colleague or friend. And if you want to show us some extra love, head over to Habits Weekly. Come and join our community. Pro members get access to a wealth of resources and the chance to interact with leading practitioners. It's a great way to support the podcast and deepen your understanding of behavioral design. Our fantastic show music is Murgatroyd by the wonderful Dave Pizarro, and thanks to the team at Orange Wall Media for the production of this episode. For questions or ideas for future episodes, email podcast@habitweekly.com. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks again for listening. See you next time.
Heavens to Murgatroyd! Oh,
Blau.
We have had a, I think excitingly, Habit Weekly has had a baby, I was going to say. I don't know what to say.
That's fine to say.
So Habit Weekly has had a baby in a way.
Okay, I'm sorry. Good.
Okay.
I'm okay.
Okay. So Habit Weekly has, in a way, had a baby, you could say, in that Baby Bites came to be this year, spawned out of
Habit Weekly. Baby Bites. You said Baby Bites. Did you mean behavior bites?
What did I say? Did I not say the behavior baby, bites?
Iron baby bites.
Okay.